November 11th, 2009, it's the Watt from Pedro Show.
You can dance, you can jive, having the time of your life.
Ooh,
see that girl, watch that scene, digging the dancing queen.
Friday night and the lights are low, looking out for the place to go. Where they play the right music, getting in the swing, you come to look for a king. Anybody could be that guy. Night is young and the music's high. With a bit of rock music, everything's fine, you're in the mood for a dance. And when you get the chance, you are the dancing queen, young and sweet, only 17. Dancing queen, feel the beat from the tambourine. You can dance, you can drive, time of your life. Ooh, see that girl, watch that scene, digging the dancing
from Pedro Show, Wednesday, 11th day of the 11th month, 2009, just back from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and 4 days ago, November 7, was the first gig for Iggy and the Stooges 2009. James Williamson on the guitar. Scott Ashton on the drums. Of course, Ig singing. Brother Steve McKay on the sax. A little keyboard, some tambourine. And, myself, Mike Watt, playing Raw Power, Ron Ashton bass lines. And, it's a pretty intense gig. I was so, so nervous. Today, I'm just in my pad by myself. Right before the gig, we played the Planeta Terra Festival 2009 in Sao Paulo. And right before, after the sound check, but before we, maybe an hour or two before we left for the gig, had chow near the tell and did an interview with James Williamson. Very interesting. Last show, we had an interview from 2001, February 27th, I believe, with Ron Ashton in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And so, a neat thing to follow up with James about his musical journey. Hell, it was like 84 minutes or something, 82 minutes. So maybe we get into it right now, at least the first part of it, and finish it up in the next hour. Yeah, it was an emotional gig. Really. I'm so nervous. Ig said I could wear black flannel. So I got a black flannel. Solid black. And Ico-san said maybe black Levi's to go with it. I've never worn black Levi's. I hardly wear black outfits. I can't remember when I last... I think in the Minutemen days I had a black button shirt I got at a thrift store once. I know I had a dark blue one, but I think I had a black one too, maybe. I wore it a couple times, or at practice. But anyway, let's get right to... did I say what we started? I didn't say the songs. Sorry, we started off the show with John Coltrane doing Three Little Words, and then we heard Dancing Queen, Petra Hayden's a cappella version. I think she did it for a barbershop quartet girl group, but that's all her there. Give them something to shoot for. And then we heard Shake Appeal, Iggy and the Stooges. Something James gave me, a remastered version of the album, and that was Shake Appeal from that. And without any further ado, from... November 7th, 2009, Sao Paulo, Brazil. Mr. James Williamson. Oh, yeah, and you'll hear another cat, a younger man, he brought to help him with changing guitars and stuff, a guy named Derek. Great cat. Anyway, here we go. Juan from Pedro Show.
This is probably not inner conversation, but you guys are guys. The thing that put my wife off a little bit, it was the first gig she ever saw. We were at the Whiskey, and there was a kind of a hooded walkway that came from upstairs dressing rooms all the way down to the stage, right? And so when it was time to come on, Iggy decided he needed to take a piss. So he's pissed all the way down the walkway, going on the stage.
That's creative. It's November 7th, 2009. I'm in Sao Paulo here with James Williamson. Derek.
James, where did you grow up? Where were you a boy?
Where was I born and where did I grow up? Well, I was born outside of San Antonio, Texas, in a little town called Castroville, which is a little kind of one-horse Alsatian town, maybe 20 minutes out of San Antonio. And my father was the only doctor in the town, so, you know, country doctor. And but he passed away when I was four, and so then we moved into San Antonio. And a few years later, my mom remarried an Army colonel, and so I became an Army grad. And so we lived in San Antonio for a few years, and then we moved to around a bit, moved to Oklahoma, to Lawton, Oklahoma, and then ended up in Michigan, in Detroit.
Music, when did you first get turned on? What's your first experience with music?
Well,
is it San Antonio there?
Really? No, in Lawton, actually.
Lawton?
Yeah, I got my first guitar was a Sears Silvertone F-hole guitar. And it had, you know, the action on it was about, you know, 2 inches high, right?
Stick your hand between the
string. Yeah, I'm trying to play this thing, and it wasn't working. But anyway, I decided I probably needed some help. So my mom popped for some lessons from a local guy. And I always forget whether his name was Rusty Sparks or Rusty McDonald, but I think it was Rusty McDonald. Anyway, he also had a local country and western, you know, TV show. So he taught me to play a few things, you know, like Good Old Mountain Dew and so forth. And then as soon as I could actually play them, he put me on his show.
Wow.
So then a lot of my friends saw me, and I had to.
How old were you then?
That was in seventh grade.
So like 13?
Yeah.
What made you want you to get that silver tone in the first place?
You know, I had gotten exposed to Elvis early on from my sister. I thought it looked pretty cool. I'd like to play it.
Were you listening to records or radio?
Yeah. I listened to records from my sister's boyfriend would bring over 45.
And what made guitar? Oh, because Elvis played one. I was thinking rather than drums.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I got going with that, but I didn't do much with it. And then when I moved to Detroit, it just so happened that I moved next door to a family called the Blacks, and their whole family played music. The oldest boy was a folk singer in college and stuff, and pretty good, you know, kind of like the Kingston Trio kind of guys. And the younger boy, Ken, was...
Oh, they had a band.
They had a real band, yeah.
Because in Oklahoma,
they
weren't in a band.
This is Detroit, yeah.
Yeah, right, but before that, Oklahoma,
I was never in a band, no. So,
but you went on to the show.
But yeah, I went on to the show.
Did you do a recital?
So I got showbiz, you know.
Would you do like a solo tune?
Yeah, I just played and sang the song, right?
Wow.
Yeah, and you know, they had a really good country and western band. You know, they had a, you know, steel guitar player and all these guys that could really kick ass. You know, they were country guys. You know?
Right.
So
they're backing you.
Yeah, more or less. You know, like go. Anyway, you know, trying to make me look good.
Yeah.
And
did you have a stage name?
No, it was my name. And so anyway, in Detroit, I moved next to this family, and this guy that was a couple years older than me could really play guitar pretty good. He played electric guitar. And so, you know, I decided I actually was going to learn how to play it. So I spent my entire first summer hanging out at his house, learning how to play bar chords and
Well, how old are you at this point?
Eight. I'm going into eighth grade.
Oh, so it's not too long after?
No.
Okay.
And, you know, he got me so I could do all the, you know, necessary stuff. And then he got me, you know, sort of convinced that I needed an electric guitar because it was a hell of a lot easier to play one, for one thing. And so I did. I got a Fender Jaguar for my first electric guitar. And, you know, went on from there.
Right. Did you make a band with him? Or just showing you stuff, right?
He just showed me stuff, but, you know, so we progressed through a, you know, this is about the time when the Beatles are breaking, right?
And so, 63, 64.
Yeah. And so, you know, very quickly, everything evolved from sort of the Beach Boys to Beatles.
Yeah.
And, but I learned how to play surf music and, you know, all that kind of stuff, too.
It's a Jaguar.
Yeah, well, you had to do it.
Oh, what about amp?
I had a Sears Silvertone amp.
So you didn't leave the Silvertone all behind?
No,
you kept
no. Well, I had my uncle work for Sears.
Ah.
So he could get me a discount, you know.
Right, right, right.
I've always been partial to the discount. And they're pretty good little amps, really. But anyway, I didn't know any better. The first band was, I guess it was in ninth grade, and we put together a band that did, you know, Stones covers and things like that. And that was Chosen Few, and that's where I first met Ronnie, because the band went through various different iterations, but. I mean, I left the band like by the end of ninth grade, but I still knew all the guys. And so, you know, when I'd come back, I'd, you know, check them out. And Ronnie started playing bass for him. So,
were you in the band then, or did you
know? No, I was not in the band then. So I happened to be going up to a gig with him, and I got to see Ron play. And Iggy was there too, so I met him at the same time.
Did you do gigs with Chosen Few? What were the gigs like?
Well,
ninth graders, I'm trying to think.
Yeah, mostly we would do, you know, like high school auditoriums and things like that for dances.
Yeah, because this is your first gigs, right?
My first gig.
Besides the TV show.
Yeah, you know, we'd do Stones covers, and the singer could do a pretty good Mick Jagger, you know. And so we would, you know, we'd play those things, and kids liked that. And then later I sort of played around with some other guys in different bands and stuff. So we were convincing. I mean, we could actually, you know, do the progressions and play the, you know, pre thing stuff, and
he'd listen to records and copy
the records and copy them, you know, Yardbirds. And
but when did you start writing?
Well, that's the funny thing is I started almost immediately because I was having trouble, you know, learning all the other songs from other people, and so it was just easier for me to just, you know, sit around and bang out my guitar and do my own stuff.
Right, right, right.
And that's what I did. And so I kind of developed or evolved a certain style that's kind of unique to me because that's what I did. You know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
That was what probably led to me being in the Stooges in the first place, was because Ig, like I say, I met him the same night when I was up in Ann Arbor with the Chosen Few, and I started playing him some of my songs, you know, because he was a cool guy from the Prime Movers, and I wanted to impress him, and so I, you know, played all this stuff, but of course I play, you know, really fast chord progressions,
yeah, right.
And you know, he was like going, you know, kind of like, what the hell is this? But he remembered that. And you know, later on, that kind of the one thing led to another, and I ended up in the band.
Did you see Iguanas?
I never saw the Iguanas. I saw a lot of the Prime Movers. Yeah, now, they were a great band.
So you start to write your own. Did you make another band after Chosen Few?
Not anything that really stuck. I was in a series of bands that we tried to put together, but they didn't. They never really gelled.
This is all during high school.
No, well, not so much in high school, but really, well, yeah, I guess it was towards the end of high school. But we never really gigged or anything. We just played a lot.
Right, right.
And did a lot of drugs, you know. But after high school, I moved to Ann Arbor. And that's where I...
You weren't in Ann Arbor yet?
No, I was in Detroit.
Oh.
Yeah, I would go to Ann Arbor, drive to Ann Arbor.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Okay, I understand.
So, after the Stooges released The Stooges, which I heard right after they did it, because I was in New York at the time, and Iggy came over where I was and asked me to come over to Danny Field's house and listen to it.
You had moved from Ann Arbor to New York City?
No, I was just in New York City.
Just visited?
Yeah. And so he came by my hotel and say hi and everything and said, come on over and listen to this. And so, you know, it sounded great.
Were you there for music or just to check the town out?
Just there to check the town out. I had some buddies with me and, you know, so on. But...
Is that when you met Danny? I know Danny.
That was the first time I met Danny. And so anyway, then when I moved up to Ann Arbor, pretty soon after I went up there, I moved in with a bunch of the guys from the band. So like Zeke Zettner, who was the bass player of them, and Bill Cheatham, who is a rhythm guitar player.
So this is after Dave.
No, Dave was still alive, but he wasn't in the band anymore.
That's what I meant.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Let me finish. So, Funhouse.
Yeah, so they... That's about the time when
you must have...
That's about the time when they did Funhouse.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, they still had Jimmy Silver managing them.
We got him.
So Jimmy Silver was still in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
That was just towards the end of when he was with them. And, clearly, Bill was a sweet guy, but he couldn't play guitar with the band.
This is the version where they had two guitars.
Yeah.
And a bass, yeah.
So, you know, basically they realized that he wasn't reliable on the instrument.
He's an old buddy of Ronnie's, right?
Well, he was a roadie, right?
Oh,
right. So he was buddies with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Really nice guy. And the band had a history of basically on-the-job training on instruments, right?
Right.
So they thought they could pull him together, but this wasn't going to happen.
What about the first line? Did you see them when they were called Psychedelic Stooges?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What were those gigs like? You know, because I asked people, because this was the days of the one song, right?
Well, yeah, I don't know if you'd call it a song, but they were incredible. I saw them before they ever played gigs. I saw them when they used to rehearse in their basement. And,
Ashton.
Family
house, right?
Well, it was, this was, they were already living in a house together.
Oh, okay.
This is the Toad's Hall.
Right.
Toad Hall, what they called it. And, they would just practice down in the basement and Scotty had oil drums and, you know, they were wild. I mean, they really were.
With the blender.
Yeah. So I saw quite a few of those gigs at the Grandy Ballroom and different places. I mean, I saw all the stuff like, you know, Iggy shaving off all his eyebrows with the glitter and all that stuff.
You know, when they went to do the first album, they came back with songs.
Right.
Now, were those gigs different?
Totally different.
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't have songs. They were
right.
They were somewhere in between John Cage and Sun Ra.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was like they just made these sounds.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, Iggy's such a performer.
Right. Right.
So he would do all this shit, you know, and like you say, you know, he played a blender and he played a vacuum cleaner and, you know, a bunch of shit like that. And everybody was so stoned that it kind of worked, you know, right?
Then they went to California to make the Funhouse. Were those gigs different from the first album gigs? Did you see them with Steve McKay?
I don't know if I ever did see him with McKay. I must have, but I don't remember it.
Did you ever see Steve with the Carnal Kitchen and this?
No. Okay. No. So anyway, they evolved pretty quickly when they started.
Because I don't know a lot about this unit, this post Funhouse, pre Raw Power. They have this kind of everything's in flux. There's some roadies. Playing,
right? Yeah. There was after Funhouse.
Yeah.
The roadies started playing. Like,
right. Because Dave, something at Goose Lake happened.
Dave would get drunk, and so he couldn't play basically, and he screwed up so bad he fired him.
Right.
And you know, you can't blame the guy. I mean, he just was not reliable. And
did you know Dave?
Yeah, I know him. Yeah, not very well, but I knew him. So,
they had a guy named Recca, Jimmy Recca.
Yeah, that was different. We're kind of jumping around.
Oh, okay.
But, sorry. So I got into the band.
Oh, yeah, because Recca's in the band when you're in the band.
Yeah. But I got into the band because Bill was also not a guitar player.
Right.
And so they wanted somebody.
And who's on the bass at this point?
Zeke,
right.
But then, very quickly, Zeke decided, you know, the band was getting into trouble with drugs, and you know, Iggy was not at all reliable, and so it was up and down. Zeke finally got fed up with it and moved back to Detroit, which was the worst thing he could possibly do because he ended up dying of an overdose. But anyway, I brought in Jimmy Recca, who was in one of the bands that I had, you know, one of the group of guys that I've been playing with.
Yeah.
And so then he was in the final lineup that we had that, you know, was captured on that 1971 album.
Right. Two guitars, mm-hmm. You and Roddy, Jimmy Recca, bass, Big, and Scotty. They'd get you guys to go to New York City and play.
Yeah. I think we played, yeah, or with Electric Circus.
Electric Circus.
Yeah. Yeah, we did a run at, you know, by then Jimmy Silvers was gone and Danny Fields was managing the band. He took us to New York and we played some gigs. And then we were hoping that Elektra would renew the record deal to make a third Elektra record.
Right.
But they didn't. A couple of the execs, what was named Harvey and Gallucci, came over to the house to hear the new music, and I don't think they knew what to make of it, because by then I was writing all new songs with Iggy, and it was this other style, so it wasn't real simple songs like they had been doing.
Right.
Can
you tell me what songs those first ones were?
Well, one of them is on the 1971 album, so if it's called You Don't Want My Name, You Want My Action, and that one was either the first one I ever wrote or close to it.
Yeah.
So that was one of them, so you can hear that. But
so they're listening to this, and they're saying this isn't the old Stooges.
Well, I can't tell I could just tell by the look on their face that they were going like, what is this?
Yeah.
We got that a lot.
Yeah, I imagine.
But I think the real, you know, sort of the crowning event was going up to Ronnie's apartment and seeing all this Nazi shit everywhere, right? And these guys were just like, get me out of here, right?
Wouldn't Bill Cheatham, they gassed him to leave?
Hmm?
Bill Cheatham. They gassed him to leave, and then he says, hey, I've been listening to James Williams, so why don't we bring him in? Is that how it happened?
No, you know, it was kind of funny. I think that they all kind of recognized, you know, Bill was no dummy. I mean, he knew he wasn't holding his own in the band. And so I think that he kind of said, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this. And they kind of said, yeah, you know, you're right.
Right.
So they, and we had been all living together.
Right,
so
right.
Everybody kind of was new to each other, was communicating with each other and stuff. So
he said, well, Bill's gone. Why don't you come in, James? Something
right,
like that?
Exactly, yeah.
So, now what's the plan? Elektra won't go.
Yeah, well, so things fell apart pretty quickly after that because there was no money coming in. We played a couple of gigs and then the kind of the crowning thing was when Scott Ashton was coming to a gig at the Grandy Ballroom and didn't see that the bridge was not high enough to drive
the truck
through. So he basically got thrown from the truck. He's lucky he's alive.
Yeah.
And
Steve McKay, you ended up doing the gig though.
Right, we ended up doing the gig because Steve McKay, we basically told him to play the drums because we needed the money. And so we played the gig. It was the most
so that's the first
effect.
Time you saw Steve play.
That was the first time I saw Steve play. And in fact, when I rejoined this group, I called him up because we were going to play a gig with the Caro's Hearts. I told him, you know, the last time I played with you, you were playing the drums for us, and he remembers it well, right? Because it was just terrible. Iggy, it was embarrassing because Iggy had to. In Steve's defense, he'd never heard the song.
Yeah, right.
And so Iggy had to sort of try to teach him the songs. That was the gig, basically. Show everybody, us showing Steve how to play the drums. And we got through it somehow and got paid, but it was really embarrassing. After that, we kind of stopped.
Okay.
And I had hepatitis by then, so, and I didn't even know it.
Hepatitis? Oh, man.
Yep. I didn't even know it. And so, I wasn't feeling too good.
No.
So I ended up moving back to Detroit and staying on my sister's couch.
Yeah.
And, some time went by and I got over that. By then, Iggy had gotten a record deal with Columbia. So, you know, he called me up one day and says, you know, you want to go to England? You know, at first I had to go have lunch with somebody. I forget the guy's name right now. He wasn't even there by the time we got to England. But he was a main man guy. And
main man was a management company.
Right.
David Bowie.
Right, that's who got him the record deal. And so I had lunch at the airport, and then a couple weeks later, you know, I get the call, you want to go, like it was like tomorrow or something. Well, you know, like
I forgot
that.
An important thing.
Yeah.
Those gigs you were doing with that band, that 71 band, what guitar were you playing?
SG,
still have that Jaguar?
SG. No, SG.
Oh, okay.
I did still have the Jaguar.
Right, but you had moved.
But I wasn't playing in the band. And in fact, well, two things. One, I wish I had the Jaguar still.
Sure.
And secondly, I wish I had the SG still.
Sure.
But I traded both of them for the Les Paul.
Right.
But
where'd you get the SG? Ann Arbor?
No, I think I got it in Detroit. I think I brought it up to Ann Arbor when I moved there. I can't remember where.
What'd you use for amps?
I started out using Ampegs, and I liked them, but they weren't as biting as they needed to be for the Stooges, and yeah. So I sold them and got Marshalls. Yeah.
So those gigs you're doing SG through Marshall?
Yeah.
Was it brand new? Was it a new SG?
Probably was, yeah.
For those days. So, Ig asked you to come to England.
Right. So, it was really short notice. So short that my sister didn't even really know I had already gone.
Wow.
And so, because my girlfriend at the time called her up and she didn't know. And she said, my sister said, I don't know whether he's gone or not. And my girlfriend said, well, check the closet and see if his guitars are still there. And sure enough, they weren't. So, pretty obvious.
You hadn't traded for Les Paul yet?
No, I had already.
Oh, you had?
Yeah, I had the Les Paul and I had a. I had something else. I can't. Maybe I still have the SG. But no, I didn't. I traded that in for that.
In Detroit?
In Ann Arbor.
Ann Arbor. So Les Paul comes from Ann Arbor.
Yeah.
Les Paul we're talking about is the one he's going to play tonight.
That's right.
All these years, it's on the cover of the Raw Power. You might look at it.
I'm sorry to jump in here, but I just figured something interesting out about that Les Paul. We thought it was a 1970. It's a 69. Because it has this is getting really geeky, but it has a one-piece mahogany neck. In 1970, they went to a
three-piece lanyard.
Oh. So that's a big difference in the guitar.
Wow.
A lot of people.
Big time in the sound.
Translates to the sound. So I don't know either way, but.
No, I know the basses.
I've been meaning to tell you that since yesterday, since I restrung it.
I know the basses when they went to three pieces. Different that sound than one piece.
The necks are definitely more stable.
More stable, but the sound is different. Maybe not as good tuning, but I think, you know, you're dealing with one piece of wood, so more true.
More resonance.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I jumped in.
No, it's cool. That's a good thing to know.
No.
I get asked about that guitar all the time, so I wanted to talk about it.
Well, it's you know, I.
So you bring that guitar to England.
I brought that with me to England.
Yep. Did it come with you, or was he already there?
No, we both went on the plane together. Okay. In fact, when we landed, they wouldn't let us in the country because we were unsavory-looking guys, and we had no visible means of support, even though we just had a $100,000 record deal, which was a lot of money in those days.
Yeah.
But they detained us for quite some time, and they finally got a hold of DeFries, and he came down and got us out.
His management guy.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's that.
So you're in England. You're gonna write a record.
Right. And so you know, one of the first things I did was to. Go to a music store and get an acoustic guitar. So I got the Gibson B25 Natural was what I wanted. It was kind of smaller.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turned out to be a great guitar for me. It's really kind of a shitty guitar, is the truth of the matter, but it was perfect for me because I liked the thin neck and it had pretty good action on it. So I could play it okay. Because the Les Paul Custom that I was using, it's basically the fretless wonder thing. So, you know, there was hardly any frets on it at all.
Yeah, right.
And I had them filed down even further, you know. So it's like, I don't know how I played that thing, to be honest with you. But you could play it really fast. So I wanted an acoustic that was, you know, had some similarities. And so that's why I got that one.
You could write songs on it.
Right, because you can make a lot of noise and these English, you know, gigs that we have.
Yeah, where were you staying?
They started us out at a hotel called the Royal Gardens, which is a really posh, you know, sort of a upscale hotel near is it Kensington Park? Yeah. Right off of Kensington Park, and they put us in the honeymoon suite. So here's Iggy and I in the honeymoon suite. So, you know, the first order of business is who gets the bed? Because we're not sleeping together. And so we determined that he was going to go out in the living room because they had a rollaway out there, and I was going to get the bed. So that's what happened.
Oh, another thing I forgot to ask you. When you were playing there in Ann Arbor,
mm-hmm.
were you interested in other guitars? You were just in your James world. Were you checking out things other guys were doing? Ronnie, Dr. Wayne Kramer, Fred Sonic Smith.
I missed that whole thing. I was later. And so I saw those guys play a couple of times.
Yeah.
But it wasn't my style. I didn't really. I mean, I knew all the guys knew each other and stuff a little bit.
But, yeah. On the music tip.
My old singer formed a Scott Richard, whatever group, SRC, whatever. Yeah. I forget what C stands for, but anyway, he had a couple brothers, the Quackenbush brothers, that were good guitarists.
Yeah.
But I thought the music stunk. And so, it's just guys with good technique playing crappy music.
Now, when you go over to England, did you guys check out some musicians there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The whole game plan was originally to go over and put together a rhythm section with English guys. And they were pushing, the main man was pushing pretty hard to do that. So we spent, months, maybe 8 weeks or something like that, roughly, sort of auditioning guys and seeing who was available and so on. And I just couldn't relate to it at all. I mean, I'm from Detroit, and here's these guys, and they're all wearing frilly cuffed shirts and big hair and, posing and doing all this stuff, and it wasn't working for me. So just one night I remember distinctly sitting there watching TV with them in the honeymoon suite. And I said, look, why don't we just bring the Ashtons over? We know those guys can play, and just move on to bass. And, we had both seen Ron play bass. He's a good bass player. And that's what we did. And we called them up the next day, and I got on an airplane, and they were delighted to have the job. There's been a lot of things said since then, but that was that's what happened.
So they come on over. Now, had you been writing songs besides auditioning the England guys?
We had been trying to. And we also had lots of material from sort of the last throes of the Stooges. So we had stuff like "I'm Sick of You" and "I Gotta Write" and that sort of thing. And that's what we used. Well, after we got them over, we started rehearsing like crazy because we thought we were going to be playing a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
And we got pretty good.
And you got one gig.
And then we got one gig. So, King's Cross, and it was a great gig. And
yeah, would you play at that gig? Is there any recordings of that gig?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
But there was, of some?
15 minutes.
Really? Who had them?
I think I have it.
You have it?
I think I do. I need to check. But
what was on
really
it?
Really bad quality.
Oh.
I think it's I'm Sick of You. I got it right.
Yeah, we did those two. But the thing is that there was so many people that later would become in bands.
Right, that went to that game.
And
I did a radio thing with Steve Jones, and he told me he was there.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of people in there. And then there's a lot of people who weren't there that said they were there, So I don't know.
Probably 10 times the capacity of the club.
But it was, you know, Iggy is very confrontational, and so for the English in basically 73, they were horrified by this singer getting out in the audience and
you remember the gig good?
Oh yeah. Well, he was getting in everybody's faces, especially the girls, of course. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, after that gig, I think that was partially why we didn't get any more, was that, you know, DeFries was worried that we were gonna, you know, cause some kind of a offense of some kind.
Right.
And
oh, you're Mick Rock was, I think, the only guy who took pictures.
Yeah, Mick Rock was one of Bowie's photographers.
Yeah, like no one else had a camera in the place. Well, but you're talking about these guys with the shirt. Now, you had an interesting outfit.
Well, that was later.
Well, what'd you wear at that gig?
I just wore a...
Well, Ike's got the jacket.
Yeah. And I just
you know there's a story behind that jacket.
Well, yeah.
It's been around.
But before I get to that yeah. I just wore blue jeans and boots and yeah, kind of like what I'm wearing today.
Yeah, yeah.
Blue jeans and a white shirt and a leather jacket. You know, colored leather jacket.
Well, was there any influence?
But what we started doing even in that gig was started putting on white face.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And so both of us were kind of in white face. And
whose idea was that?
Well, it was kind of my idea, but I was trying to be cool. But the truth of the matter is we had no skills with any kind of makeup or anything. So it came out as kind of like some kind of weird clown. So anyway, while we were in England, you know, we spent a lot of time hanging out with Bowie and Robson and Angie Bowie and so forth. And so, you know, they were slowly, you know, sort of trying to upgrade our wardrobe. And we found that one day looking around, and that's where he got that jacket. He wore it all the time over there. Yeah.
It ended up in Hollywood. I think Long John Silver had it again. Simply for the Record guy, but Stan Lee had it for a little while. The guitar player for the Dickies.
Mm-hmm.
It's a whole story.
Eric Powers was asking you about that one.
Yeah, there's a whole thing about that jacket. You don't get any more gigs, and you're gonna have to record, right? So you're putting together songs.
So now we're concentrating on recording. And what happened was we went from one studio to another trying to find the right combination of engineers, sound, you know, all that kind of stuff, and doing demos. And we kept thinking, well, it's kind of like Derek and I were talking about these guitar players that buy guitars constantly thinking that somehow that will make it better.
Right.
And it was kind of like that. We were kept going to different studios hoping that
it would do it
for us, right?
I think Scotty told me he even did Bill Wyman studio some songs.
I don't remember that, but we could have. We did the studio where the Faces recorded a lot, you know, and I think they did Maggie May with his engineer and all this stuff. Anyway, we kept recording stuff like I Got a Ride, you know, I'm Sick of You, and all those things you hear the recordings from as demos. We'd bring them back to Main Man and they'd reject them.
It's so lame because it's your record deal, but you have to go through this filter.
Yeah, because
it's almost like they held the deal.
They did, really. I mean, they control. They were very, very controlling. Tony DeFries thought he was the Colonel Tom Parker. Uh-huh. That's who he was modeling himself after. And so he had very definite ideas about how to break stars and how to make them look like stars and so on. And it worked pretty well with Bowie.
Yeah.
And it worked so well with Bowie, in fact, that that he got very busy with him.
Right.
And once that happened, we actually could go about our own business because nobody was watching us anymore.
Right.
And that that turned out to be a good thing and a bad thing at the same time, because the good thing was we made raw power and nobody stopped us.
Right.
And the bad thing was we did a crappy job of it because nobody had any technical skills in the studio.
Yeah.
And the poor engineer had to listen. You know, this is my first album ever.
Right.
So I knew nothing.
Right.
And the engineer was trying to work with us, but, you know, Iggy's basically, you know, calling the shots because he's done albums before.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, he's just kind of bossy by nature. And so he's telling us that poor engineer how to do everything. And, of course, the result is some things.
What studio did you end up at?
It was a new CBS, you know, Columbia studio here in London. It was a great studio.
Okay, there you have the first part of two of a spiel from James Williamson on his musical journey, done November 7, 2009 in Sao Paulo, Brazil, some chow pad near the tail. Very interesting. His journey. He's on a TV show. Look at that, as a boy singing Mountain Dew. As I told him, I think it's very interesting to show people that everyone has their own path in their music journey. And that's why it's kind of relentless on getting the timeline and show how things progress. And a lot of things, yeah, you can't predict, and they just seem to happen. And we're at the end of the first hour of the November 11th, 2009 Watt from Pedro show, part two, second final part of his spiel, coming in the next hour, so hold tight. November 11th, 2009, second hour of the Watt from Pedro show, and here's the second of two parts, final part, of an interview with James Williamson, guitarist from the Raw Power days, right? Iggy and the Stooges, and now in the new 2009 version, which we did our first gig. A couple hours after we did the spiel. November 7, 2009, Sao Paulo, Brazil. Here we go.
So, you know, as I've said to people, the thing about it is that despite all the weird mixes, the weird levels, you know, all the stuff, it's the songs that just cut through all of that, and no matter, it's like you can't stop them, you know, you can't screw them up no matter how hard you try.
You guys had a lot of tunes, though, that were left off.
Yeah, we had been writing kind of constantly,
right.
And we just picked them.
They made
the stuff that we, you know, thought made kind of sounded together.
Did it get mixed in Cali?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, did it get mixed in?
Because the original mix, again, Main Man wanted, and I think David Bowie wanted to, because he was producing a lot of bands back then, so Mötley Crüe, all those guys. You know, he always was pretty good in the studio, but we kind of had, I don't know that I would say we rejected him, but let's just say we changed the subject every time it came up. So then by the time we had our mixes and we were ready to release the album, of course they had to go back to Main Man, and of course the first thing they did was reject the mixes, and it was,
is that the whole band or Ig?
It's Yeah, it's Main Man, you know, discussing this with Iggy.
No, but I mean, when you guys, that mix.
Well, yeah, it was kind of a, I mean, the whole band was...
with an engineer.
Together in the studio, and we kind of, you know, discussed things. And, you know, and it was good. Everybody liked it. The band liked it.
Right, right.
And that's what we thought we were going to release. But right. Then when it came, when Main Man heard it, of course, they couldn't stand it because they never understood us anyway. And so the first thing they said was, well, you know, we got to have David come in and salvage this, right? And so, you know, he's on tour, and I think they picked Western Studios on Santa Monica.
Yeah.
Santa Monica, I think it is. Which isn't there anymore, but that's where he went in to mix it. And at the time, we had just come back over. Iggy went first, and then I came out and I sat in on most of the mixes. And you know, it was just really clear that he didn't. You know, this is just not David Bowie's thing. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And is that your first time to Cali?
Yeah. Yeah, so, well, no, I mean, we had taken a car trip once, you know, when I was young.
Okay.
And visited Disneyland and, you know, things like that. But, I mean, it was my first real time staying there. So, anyway, he does this mix, and everybody in the band just absolutely hates it.
Oh, the Ashtons are there, too.
They came later, but... But they weren't participating in the mix like I was.
Because right. I heard that they got the thing in the mail.
Yeah, we got the records. Yeah, and Scott was... Everybody flipped out. But
Scotty flew it.
For me, though, it was more like, okay, well, at least I got an album. You know,
yeah,
maybe
sure,
not
sure.
Sound right, but I got an album.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, but I knew that it wasn't going to go anywhere because my girlfriend... you know, who was way into music, I had her listen to it, and you could just tell from the look on her face that, you know, it was like, oh my God, you know, it's like, what is this? And
that could be a good thing.
Well, that's pretty much the reaction everybody had. So,
hey James, what time do you have?
8:06.
Yeah, 8:06. So you got a little while.
So. Now the record's going to come out, and you guys are now relocated
mm-hmm.
to Hollywood.
Right.
Start doing gigs.
We started out, Jim and I were staying at the Beverly Hills Hotel, which was really cool.
Yeah.
But then we had a limo at our disposal.
Man.
You know, I mean, it was really high style, because that's the way they wanted us to be. And, well, of course, that was a terrible idea for the two of us, you know. Because you can imagine what we used that limo for. So pretty soon they decided, well, maybe they ought to have a little more supervision on us. And they found a house, and they brought Lee Black Childers out to sort of, you know, live in the house. And he kind of lived above a garage off of the house. And with the rest of the band got moved up into the house. That's the one on Torrey Sound in up in Mulholland.
Yeah, I took Scotty up there. It faces the valley.
All right.
Drove him there so he could see it again. He hadn't seen it all these years.
Yeah, for some reason, Bob Matthew didn't actually, if we took Paul Trinka up there, we didn't get the right house.
Scotty said it looked the same, the one.
Scotty would know.
It didn't face Pedro, it faced the valley, it faced north.
But anyway, so we...
Beautiful view.
We did practice a lot up there. And once again, you know, we got one gig. We got a Detroit gig. And I think it was Cobo Arena.
Wow, big pack.
It was a big deal.
Yeah.
And we got a huge reception from Detroit. The only problem was that, and that's where you see all that those iconic pictures, like the boots and you
sure,
know all that
sure.
stuff. The only problem was that DeFries insisted that we not do any encores, and so because he thought that made us look like bigger stars. But what in fact happened was it pissed the crowd off.
Yeah, like kind of stuck up.
Yeah. And they, other than that,
you have a piano for that gig?
Bob Shep? Yeah, I believe we did. I think we added Bob Shep. That was the first gig where we added Shep.
Yeah. Whose idea?
My idea.
Yeah.
And because I figured I needed some, you know, the guitar being by itself, you need a little something. And so, and I always really loved the way he played. So we called him up and got him out and rehearsed with him, and then we rehearsed up there with him. So that worked for a while, but Bob.
You come back, you start doing some.
We did some
Hollywood
whiskey gigs and stuff later. But that was the only gig in that at that time frame. And like I say, it went from, you know, ecstasy to sort of a bummer, you know,
right.
Because of no encores.
Yeah.
And then kind of after that, we fell out with the main man organization altogether.
Bob don't stay with you either, because you end up getting.
Well, we didn't.
Scotty Thurston, right?
Well,
got to
for
meet
a while.
A few times now.
For a while, he
did.
Yeah.
About this? It's his cockpit for practical. We have practice.
Well, the at first we did though. We had Bob Shep come out for our first gigs at the Whiskey.
Yeah.
And a couple other places, but he very quickly realized that he just couldn't hang with his band. You know, it was really bad. And, I mean, you know how we. Well, I know you don't know how we were, but it was really tough.
You know, I've heard some things.
He was fun though. He tried to, you know. By then, of course, we're wearing lots of makeup.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, all this stuff, and he tried to, you know, Bob was not a naturally kind of cool guy. And so he tried to be cool. He put Christmas tree lights in his hair, and he would turn them on, and they would flash and stuff when he was playing. And after a while, I forget what the final thing was, but I think he just said he just had enough. And
yeah.
So luckily, by then in the there was a period of time, maybe 4 weeks or something like that, where I was fired from the band.
Oh, you got thrown under the bus.
Yeah, well, that was basically, it was a combination of things, but Lee Black Trowers hated me because his good buddy was Sarinda Fox, was my girlfriend for a while, and then that didn't go too well, and she went back to New York, and so he always had it in for me. And so I was an easy scapegoat because I was no angel, and so basically I got fired for a while. And during the time when I was out on my own, I was actually living at my girlfriend's house. I met a couple of guys that were forming a band, and I was thinking I might play with them. We were at Capitol Records one day and listening to this session. And Thurston was playing in it, and so that's kind of the most valuable thing that came out of the whole thing.
Because so I could Scott see that
Scott was a cool guy and yeah. He could play well, and so I got his contact information. And when we reformed, which didn't take that long, I asked him to come play with us, and so that means he played with us to the end of that era.
Yeah, he's on Metallic KO.
Yeah.
Is that Bob Shep on the recording of Cock in My Pocket? Some people have said yes, others said it's Thurston.
I think it's Thurston because I don't think I had written that song yet. I doubt it. But Jeff, well, like I say, he didn't last that long. I can't really remember all the tunes we were playing at that time, but he made it through one set of Whiskey gigs.
Yeah. Yeah, the time period we're talking about is pretty compressed.
Yeah, it really is. A lot of shit happened in
yeah,
a
right.
short it amount of
yeah.
time.
It was the last gigs in 74.
Yeah.
73 was like when the record's done.
It was kind of like 72... to 74.
Right, 2 years.
Yeah, not a long time.
Intense. You're a young man.
Yeah, exactly. I don't remember exactly how old I was, but I wasn't 25 yet.
Yeah, you're early 20s.
So.
Wow. And then to have the Svengali type. So finally, they scissor you guys. They take the clothes.
Well, right. So the first thing they do is dump me. And then they realize very shortly after, less than 4 weeks later, oh, it's not just him. They're all fucked up, right?
So. You got to tell them about the boots when you're wanting to gig.
Oh, yeah. Okay. This story is no longer a secret, but it is funny. So, preparing for the gig, we needed to gear up our stuff, our gear, what we're going to wear. So we went to, some local Hollywood designers and people and so forth, and I wanted to wear
boots. Same thing I do.
I wanted to wear some boots, so I went to this pretty famous Hollywood bootmaker, and I told him, what I wanted. I wanted these black boots with the kind of the gold snakeskin up the front that would go up the front, and they had to be platforms, of course, in those days.
Yeah, right.
And I wanted them to be calf high. And he tried to talk me out of that, but that's what I wanted.
Yeah,
I'm going to have it. And so I ordered them, but they took a long time to make. And so the time I got them, I didn't have very little time. I tried on, without putting on the whole boot, I tried to feed it to make sure they fit and everything. And they did. So we go to Ann Arbor, where we were staying for that gig, and practicing and so forth. And what I come to find out was that there's a reason why people don't make calf high tight boots. You couldn't sit down in the boots. Right? You're up, you're just up. And so I'm really screwed because I hadn't thought this thing through at all. This is a classic stooge thing, right? Goof. And so here we are. This is my costume. And I can't sit down. And so how am I going to get to the gig?
Yeah.
Right?
In the boat. How are you going to ride?
Exactly.
In the car?
And so I ended up having to lay in the van down, lay flat in the van. And, of course, this was hysterically funny for Ronnie and Scott, right? And then when we got there, they had to lift me out of the van, and I had to stand up for the rest of the time until it was...
You can tell in the pictures. There's a rod up your back.
So anyway, when they fired me, they kept all that stuff in a trunk, and when they fired me, they wouldn't give it to me. Oh, not that I really wanted it, but I wanted the costume and stuff.
Sure.
But anyway, I didn't get it, and they took the Ovation guitar, which was also probably a blessing.
That's right. You got an Ovation. I see it in the pictures. Yeah. I never see you playing it. I see it sitting on...
I think I played it on one song.
I see it sitting on the side of the stage.
It was kind of the backup guitar.
Okay.
But it was really, after I got it, I realized it was crap.
Terrible.
And so I really didn't play it much. It ended up... I'm sorry. That wasn't it. There was a... What was the guitar that was clear plastic?
Dan Armstrong.
I had one of those, which was also crap. But I used that a lot for the freakouts where I'd be banging the guitar.
Yeah, right.
Sturdy. But they didn't get my Les Paul.
They took those guitars. They took the clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And then what'd you guys do?
Well, so then we... what I did first was I had no skills and no means of support, so I started going to unemployment, which they wouldn't give me in those days, but they wanted you to go to a job counselor every time.
Sure.
So they had a list of a printout of all the jobs that employers were asking to fill, and they'd ask me what I could do, and I basically couldn't do anything except play the guitar.
Yeah.
And so they finally got down the list and found this projectionist. So I went in for the job, and basically it's the porno theater. And so I became the projectionist at the porno theater, and that was my job.
And was the band do gigs after the main man?
Yeah, they did. I think they had. Some of this is a blur to me because I wasn't involved in it much, but I think they went out with like Tornado Turner or somebody like that.
And then, Ruby Red or
yeah, whoever they went out with, it was god awful and they couldn't stand it.
The last one ended up being like a kind of a drama, a play. Iggs got Ronnie dressed in a...
Oh, no, that's later on.
Yeah, that's the last one, I think.
Yeah, that's a whole other story. So they get kicked out.
Yeah.
And they come looking me up right away, you know. And I'm looking...
You're showing movies.
I'm showing porno movies and thinking, well, it should be this. No matter what happens, it's got to be better than this.
So you make a band with Scotty and Ronnie.
So we just reformed the band.
Oh.
And
with Ig?
With Ig.
Okay.
And so we reformed the band. And
They got fired from the main band.
They all got fired. Yeah. Right. And so they found Helen Reddy's manager, who was Jeff Wall, who was their manager, which of course was a very unlikely, matchup. But he put us together with John, a guy named John something, I can't think of it at the moment, and John Myers. And John Myers, turns out, is the brother of the first wife of Jackson Brown, who committed suicide.
Oh.
So Jackson was not real popular in that family.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was a really nice guy, John Myers, and he's the one that hired this guy Chris Ehring as our roadie. And we got started playing again. Years later, Chris Ehring actually introduced me to my current wife, my only wife. But that's different. Anyway, with those guys, they started getting us to work. So that started a whole new series of whiskey gigs, and they were very, very successful. And then we had to add dates and all this stuff.
Yeah.
There were huge lines outside.
Right, right.
It was a big deal. And a lot of that was recorded. There's a lot of
things
out there of those deals.
Great shop.
Yeah.
Franchise.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, but that's what's kind of murky to me. What happened? Because that was kind of success. You guys bounced back a little. And then what happened?
Well,
the drug guys?
What happened was we started playing a lot.
Yeah.
But the more we played, Jim had this sort of cyclical thing because he would, and still I think he's a little bit still like this, but he's learned how to manage it a little better. He would, become very frenetic and productive, but then he would get really down and, start using drugs and stuff, and it was very unpredictable. And so we had equal measures of success and fuck ups,
yeah.
Sure. And it culminated in the Jeff Wall organization really kind of got fed up with us. So we got another manager in New York, and these guys were all business. I mean, they were all about just turning the buck. And so they put us out on this tour that I like to call the Death March, which was just one gig after another, going from one city to another, never, coming home for, weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks.
Yeah.
And we had no really ability to, the money all went to them, and then later would come to you, but only in the form of just enough to eat, and so nobody really had any money.
Yeah.
And we had to do a lot of weird stuff, skip out on hotel bills and all kinds of stuff. But
it ends up with that Metallic KO gig.
Yeah. Any money we had went to drugs or whatever.
That success in whiskey really wasn't translating out in the other states?
No, it didn't. It didn't, because the whiskey deal, you know, in Hollywood, they're pretty progressive. They just
there was a scene.
But the fact was is we were continuously writing new material, including even then. And so nobody really knew the songs we were playing. We weren't playing Raw Power, the album Raw Power, that someone might have gotten a copy of at some point, might actually recognize one song. We played all new stuff.
Pushing.
People were just like, you know, here's this guy running around without his shirt on, you know, in the audience, and he's playing all this music nobody's ever heard. And so it's not exactly a recipe for entertainment, you know. And so we were just, you know, sort of just playing for ourselves, really. And it didn't translate at all. So that just became more and more sort of desperate.
So the Detroit gig.
The Detroit gig was, at kind of the tail end of a really long tour. And these guys in New York would always try to book gigs around other gigs to make more money, which is not all bad, but they weren't doing their homework. And so they booked us into this place called the Rock and Roll Farm, kind of one or two nights before that gig. And I was a biker bar, and so we started playing it, and it went out in the audience, and you know, here's kind of a line of bikers kind of leaning up to the back of the wall, you know, and it comes up and starts getting in their face, and this one guy just hauled off and just cold cocked him, and it was really actually a pretty scary night, because we weren't sure we were going to get out of there. Because they kind of things went from bad to worse. But we did. We got out of there, and I don't even think they paid us. But that translated into some. I'm not sure. I don't even know whether to this day whether it was the bikers themselves or other people who had heard about that or what. But then they started throwing stuff and.
They show up at this. What ends up being the final game.
Yeah.
Like some kind of revenge.
Yeah, and I think it's probably the first that I've ever heard of like that. And I think it's unfortunate, but it turned into the later punk scene. You know, where people started doing that stuff, you know, spitting on people and throwing shit at them. You know, what a great legacy, you know.
Well, the band calls it quits.
Nobody had to say anything. I mean, it was just clear that this wasn't working. And so that the band kind of disintegrated after that.
Now you go back to L.A.?
Yeah. Bill Deakin and I are back in L.A.
Yeah.
And
because not too long is Kill City, right? A year or two.
The band broke up. The guy Ashton's eventually moved back to Ann Arbor. And Jim and I decided, okay, well, let's try to make another album. I know Elton John was interested in us, so we thought we might be able to get some going with Rocket. And so we made, with the help of Ben Edmonds, who lined us up with Jimmy Webb's studio, we made what would become Kill City. And we couldn't get anybody interested. And so many years later, by then I had we had another guy we were trying to get as a manager named Bennett Glotzer, very famous attorney manager guy in Hollywood. And he, one of the first things he told us to do is go ask him for the tapes. You know, so I drove up and asked them for the tapes, and they said, "Oh, here," you know, and they gave them to me. And so we had the tapes, but we ended up not using Bennett Glotzer as our manager. And so I had the tapes, and then Iggy ended up going with Bowie out. You know, Bowie took him under his wing. And so years later, Greg Shaw was interested in all this stuff, and so he kind of bankrolled me to mix it and add some instruments on it and finish it. And that's what I did, and it became Kill City.
But after that, you worked with Ig for New Values.
Right. So anyway, well, what started out was when he was with Bowie, they hated that album when it first came out, and they thought that it, you know, they thought that it was unprofessional.
No, but how did it get made?
No, I'm talking about Kill City here.
Oh, so Kill City, yeah.
When I released Kill City with Greg, they hated it. They thought it was unprofessional, and they really made a big stink about it. But then a weird thing started happening. All the kids started buying it, right? And they were buying it more than his stuff. And so he was shopping for a new record deal with Bowie helping him, and they pointed to the success of this other album as being a reason to sign him, and he ended up getting a deal out of it. So then all of a sudden he started liking it. And it is true. It probably is the first real indie record ever. Yeah. So it has that going for it. So what do we got? 171, 3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 40, 3, 6, 9, 12, 14, 31 is 50. So it's about 50.
160 each be 180?
Yeah, but that's the tip's already on there.
So a little over?
Yeah.
60 be too much?
50, probably, 55, probably.
Do you have change? 50, or can I owe you 3?
You can owe me 3.
Okay.
I don't have a lot of change here.
The bank of Williamson is getting depleted.
Yeah, I'm not getting my... Did you get your per diems from Henry?
I did, yeah.
55, okay.
Well, I gotta run.
Okay. Do you know how to get back?
Yeah. Okay. I walked it earlier today, so... Thanks for inviting me over.
You're welcome.
I'd like to give you one of these. All of us in the band have been influenced by your various things. And our drummer, Eric, has played with you before when you played in San Jose, I think, at the Cactus.
He gave Bro Got Sick.
Yeah. He was in a...
Cactus
I think it was
Club.
With Clay...
San
no,
Jose.
It was Sloan. S-L-O-E.
Oh, Sloan.
Yeah.
Yeah, Canadian guys.
No, not Sloan. Sloan. S-L-O-E. Harris.
And Slowberry.
Yeah. All right.
Thanks, this is Eric. Service, right?
Yeah.
Okay, see you over there. So anyway, where are we? So we released Kill City.
Yeah.
And
they're surprised by the result.
They're surprised, but they eventually adjust to it and they liked it. So then, time goes by and Iggy and Bowie aren't doing stuff together anymore. And now Iggy's got a deal on Aerosmith. And so they're... I think Ben Edmonds was also suggesting this, but Iggy was trying, Iggy's not the easiest guy to work with in the studios, and typically producers, they don't work well together with him, and so he was looking for a producer that could work with him, and I think he's told me this recently, and so I didn't realize it at the time, but what he was really looking at was for me to write some new songs for him.
Wow.
And I wrote one, but I didn't realize it at the time that that was my real job. So anyway, but he wanted
new
me to
values.
Yeah, so he wanted me to produce them too, and because I had been working in a studio and so forth, and so I had some skills and so on. And so I did that, and I brought that album in under budget. I think it's a polished effort. We worked hard on that album, and it holds up well. That was good. But then the subsequent album, Soldier,
right.
Again, I was asked to help him produce
because of the results of New Values.
Well, except for... Oh, okay, receipt. Okay, thank you. But the record company wasn't happy with New Values because it was too clean. And they were all, you know, English people in the punk scene. You know,
right.
They wanted another Raw Power, or another Kill City. Mm-hmm. So what we delivered them was a very polished effort. You know, the guitars were recorded cleanly, and the mix was, yeah, you could hear everything. And anyway, that's what they wanted to do. So I'm game. But it was a very concerted effort by the record company to get the kind of album they wanted. So they said, okay, we should do this in the UK with English guys. You know, we want that sound and so on. And you know, you did it on Raw Power. You can do it again. You know, kind of a thing. And I should have probably turned it down. Well, to begin with, Iggy didn't want to bring Scott Thurston over because he didn't want to pay him as much as Scotty wanted.
Yeah.
And so that was a blow because Scotty's a really good musician and he adds a lot to the party.
Yeah.
So anyway, now we had the situation of having an all new band of guys, and so I go over there and spend some time in London trying to coalesce this band, whatever it was. And it's kind of a funny story because I still hadn't been playing guitar at all. And, you know, we had lunch with Elvis Costello one day, and I'm going, you know, like, well, do you know any good guitar players? You know, he started cracking up. He goes, this is hysterical. You are asking me if I know any good guitar players.
Why don't you play?
Yeah, exactly. And I probably should have, but I didn't. And I just didn't want to.
So with Kill City, you had stopped.
Yeah, but about that time I kind of stopped. And I played a few new things on that album. I mean, that's all my guitar on that album. But I was not really that active anymore. And then it sort of dwindled off from there. So the Soldiers effort was, they wanted us to go up and stay at the studio in Wales and all these musicians just went from bad to worse. And then I was just very unhappy about the whole thing. And also I guess I took the attitude of, okay, well, if I have to do this, then I'm gonna try to do something different, you know. There was new technology available, the so-called SMPTE time code that would allow you to sync up multiple machines, you know, and I could have 48 tracks to work with, and I started getting into that, and this was driving the musicians crazy, and so, you know, and then the other thing that was happening was that because they couldn't play, I couldn't get any takes from them. And so I would just have them do take after take after take, and it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And so the musicians really were not openly, but were becoming mutinous.
Yes.
So anyway, here's this really terrible
bad sitch
situation going on, and the tracks were done with the basic tracks, and you know they weren't that hot, and so by the time all this had occurred, you know, everything had built up to a fever pitch, and it all sort of blew up one weekend. David Bowie came to visit, and because he came because he thought, well, I don't know why, but anyway, he came and he wanted to sing on the album and do stuff, and so, you know, we did all that, and that wasn't all bad, but it sort of culminated in this. It became a kind of vortex for me to be, you know, sort of done, and then he was sort of done with me because I was driving him crazy because I couldn't get any his vocals just sucked. And I couldn't get him to do a performance, and meanwhile I'm busy trying to get the band to lay down tracks, and that wasn't working. So you know how impatient he becomes. And so eventually, as I like to say, I quit and he fired me all at the same time. So
with that, was that the last? You got into another line of work.
Yeah. So I went on and finished an engineering degree and went to work in the Silicon Valley in electronics business.
Yeah.
I was.
I mean, how quick did that happen?
It took a few years.
You went to school.
I was going to school when we did New Values. And it took a few years to get through all that, and then I got hired right out of school and moved. Mm-hmm. My wife and I knew while I'd gotten married, and my wife and I moved up to the Silicon Valley. And I really never regretted that. I mean, that was an exciting thing. Well, especially that time was very exciting in that industry.
Yeah.
You know, the personal computer was just starting, and you know, I was young and it was new, so it's been a good run, you know. But
you kind of stopped playing.
But I stopped playing. Yeah.
Yeah, but you kind of did with the Kill City. But then no producing either, just no more music.
Yeah, I just said, you know, I just didn't have a
what's this about the Hawaiian guitar? I heard that you got into some...
Yeah, and so the last few years I got, my wife and I started traveling more and more often to Hawaii, so I got interested in the music one day I was shopping around at a swap meet and ran across this Koa guitar. It's a Koa wood, and it was beautiful old guitar though. And so I was looking in the hole in there and saw, you know, H. Weisenborn in there, and I didn't really know who he was other than I knew he was kind of important. And the guy selling it didn't have a clue, and so he really sold it to me for virtually nothing. And it, you know, it needed some work and everything, but then I found out, you know, later, you know, Herman Weisenborn is a very famous luthier in the 20s, and he made these wonderful, you know, lap steel Hawaiian style guitars that are to this day, you know, the kind of the gold standard of
very
that
much
style,
design.
Acoustic style. And he also made some Spanish neck guitars, which is what I bought.
Mm-hmm.
With that, I started getting interested in the so-called black key guitar, which is, you know, multiple open tunings and so forth. So I started, this guitar was really kind of a magical sounding guitar, and it talked to me, you know, and it got me, you know, stimulated to play it more and more. So I kind of found the music again, if you will. And so I was happily doing that.
5 years ago, I think he saw the Stooges in Long Beach. Scott.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Right?
Yeah. Now, in my
so you heard about the
my electronics job.
Yeah.
I had a meeting in Long Beach at the same time. And Scott was living in Long Beach at that time, and because his wife still does work near there, but Scott decided, you know, it'd be easier commute on his wife, and he ended up not staying there. But anyway, he was there then, and so my old girlfriend Evita had called and said, you know, Iggy's coming to Long Beach, and because she knew I was coming to Long Beach, and so.
Had you heard about Coachella and the band?
No, not really. I mean, I had not really, because I wasn't tuned into all that stuff.
Sure.
But I knew that you guys were playing, and so I thought, well, okay, well, shit, we couldn't get a hold of anybody, so we couldn't get. I'm not even sure if they would have put us on the guest list, or we couldn't even find out. But I Scott and I just walked in, you know, bold as anybody else, you know, through the back gate, and just said, you know, we're with the Stooges, you know, and they just let us right in. I mean, I guess two old guys like us went, why would we be bullshitting about this? And we got to, you know, see all you guys and then see you guys play.
But you see an Ig Van and Soldier.
Yeah. Yeah, he was a completely different guy.
And you hadn't really...
I had seen him play with Whitey in that whole lineup as a solo when he played the Fillmore years before that.
And not much contact.
No, almost no contact. The only contact we would have is, you know, we have some common publishing together and so forth. So business things like that, every so often we'd chat about them, but. No, I mean, we were pretty done with each other after Soldier. And so, really, this whole more recent contact is a kind of a
Oh, well, what'd you think of that gig, though?
I thought it was great. I thought Iggy was fantastic. I mean, he was like...
Much different than old days.
Yeah, he was. He did an impressive performance.
My mom saw it. My mom came to that gig.
Your mom did?
She goes, yeah, interesting man, Mr. Bob.
Yeah. Well, he did a great job, and the band sounded like the Stooges. I mean, it just sounded like itself.
Yeah.
And it was fine.
I mean, for me, it's interesting to hear somebody from those days see us in those.
But I had no interest in playing with the Stooges.
Sure.
You know, so I had never dreamed I would be doing that.
That was 5 years ago.
Yeah, that's 5 years ago.
And then this last January, Ronnie got killed with the heart.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, but meanwhile, like I say, I've been playing the slack key guitar and so forth.
So you were getting into music that way.
I was getting into it that way, and so I wasn't, you know, I wasn't really that rusty, if you will. I hadn't been playing that style, but you know, I could play music. Music's music.
Yeah. Right.
Once Ronnie had died, a little while later, well, he called me, you know, letting me know about Ronnie's death, and we discussed briefly me coming to the funeral, but I wouldn't really feel right about it without contacting the family, and of course, as you know, on a good day, Scotty's difficult to reach, and so I tried my best, both he and Kathy, but I'm sure they were getting tons of phone calls. And, you know, they just couldn't deal with it. So I never heard back, so I didn't come. But later on, you know, he called me again. He had called me again and asked me to play, would I be interested in playing? And at that time, I wasn't really. I told him, you know, look, I'll do the Hall of Fame if you guys ever do it. You know, stuff like that, but I really, you know, I don't really see this as being something for me to do. But then, very shortly after that, the company, Sony, who I was working for, started giving out these early retirement packages. And so they advanced all your retirement benefits by like 5 years, you know, I'm turning 60 this year, and you know, I wasn't going to work that many more years anyway, and so I would be working for free if I didn't take this. And so I said, okay, well, then I started really seriously thinking about taking that package, and then I started thinking, well, you know, I can't, basically the Stooges couldn't do this without me because I was the last available Stooge. Right. And so I thought to myself, you know, hey, I know these guys really well. I go back a long way with them, and I can do it. So, you know, why not? You know, let's do it. And so eventually the next time I talked to him, which is about March or April, I said, you know, I'm in. Let's do it. I mean, we had other discussions about, you know, what to expect and everything. But essentially, I said I was in. And so my actual retirement was June, and I had some things to do for the company. So I think I started rehearsing in around July, and then sort of, you know, the rest.
August, we had our first track with you.
Yeah.
First, me and Scotty did one at the end of July, us two.
Right.
And we're doing with you.
And I did some locally up where I live and stuff. So
Derek, who was here, you even did a gig.
Exactly. So it's been kind of a progression up until now, and so here we are.
September with Ig, then another one with us guys, October.
Then the last two days, one with Ig, one with us. On the night of the first reunion performance. There we go.
Thanks so much, James.
Yeah, my pleasure, man.
Everything, man.
You know, it's like... ready or not, here we come.
wanna take you out with me. Come on now, man, on my dear trip, my dear trip. What am I?
Yeah! is always trying to tell me what to do. No! Try to tell me what to do. Everybody's only trying to tell me what to do. Don't you try to tell me what to do. Wrong power, it don't wanna go. Wrong power, it's a guaranteed old. Wrong power, laughing at you and me. Do what I wanna know. Can you feel it, man? Can you feel it, man?
Watt from Pedro Show. We just heard Raw Power, Iggy and the Stooges, live in Sao Paulo at the Planeta Terra Festival. That was November 7, 2009. First song of the first gig of this new lineup, James Williamson on guitar. Before that, we had Sonic Youth doing Kill Your Idols. Ahead of that was Death Trip from Raw Power, Iggy and the Stooges, the mix James Williamson gave to me, that's been remastered. And then, of course, part two of the spiel with him in Sao Paulo, maybe a couple hours before you heard Raw Power. Pretty intense, you know, when I think about it, how all transpired like that. I'd like to thank James Williamson very much for spending time. You know, that was during his chow. You can kind of hear some chow sounds. So much respect. And I'm very grateful. Watt from Pedro. End of the second hour of the November 11, 2009 Watt from Pedro Show. Hold tight for hour three. November 11th, 2009. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro Show. From Pedro's show, started off the third hour with a band from England from the early 70s called T2. A friend of mine, Anton, from Ireland, turned me on to this. A song called No More White Horses. Then we heard At Beef's House by 7 Foot Buffer. And thirdly, something untitled but recorded September 21st, 2009. That's Shiner, Brother Taka's band, featuring Ms. Motoko Honda on organ there. And I got some music from what used to be called Yugoslavia. They're different. They're separate. They had a divorce, you know, and now they're six different countries, five, six. Let's see, Slovenia, Croatia, Bosnia, Serbia, Montenegro, Macedonia. Oh, okay, six. Wad from Pedro show.
silence and there is no fear. Together it's unreal. Bad luck's bad, you need it. Our life is now safe. We think it is okay. Sometimes you just have to try something different, happier and wise. Sometimes you just have to try some good deeds, some happiness and wise. So just forget the science. Now embrace your fear, is always so real. Good news never leads us, no one ourselves, what's written in ourselves. Sometimes you just have to try something different, happier and wise. Sometimes you just have to try some good deeds, some happiness and wise.
I cannot see. dark is the mind. You are nowhere but behind. Dear goddess, how I miss the sound. 'Cause we are kind, lawless, blind.
I am.
Watt from Pedro Show. You just heard Sprovod by Plemy. Before that was Shadow and Traveler by Bad Taste. Ahead of that, Full Bladder from Katera. In front of that, Fear and Science by the Lo-Fi Calvinists. And we started off with Crayons by the Disconsolate Manufactory. Actually, all five of them bands are from Montenegro. So just one of the those lands, republics. Is it? I think they're separate now. Anyway, interesting music. That's what I like about it. Music can come from all kinds of places, even with major nightmare hell kind of stuff. And one day I want to play in Montenegro. I've played those other ones I mentioned, except for Bosnia. I want to play there too. And I'd like to play the other ones again. I like to play everywhere. And there's going to be Stooges gigs coming in 2010. I don't know those lands especially, but I know there's a few east of our right coast, across the Atlantic, Europe, right, and England, of course. Here's something good from England. Watt from Pedro Show.
How you gonna dress? Sit in the tensions of the people and the victims there. You're ready to impress. Honest salute you, they're the fixing cash and kiss me sweet. Plenty of the way that you put on me. Feel like it's a loser when you're dead won't clean. I'm getting lonely and I'm all by the sleeve. So won't you come running? I'm a coming first time. I saw your sister, you see she's got a bad degree. It's a shame about you.
From Pedro Show. A lot of music I'm playing now because, you know, had an hour and a half straight spiel. Well, very interesting, though. Thanks again, Mr. James Williamson. Yeah, started out that chunk with something great from England. Just a duet, bass drum, called The Nice Sharp Pencils, in a song called Put Some Clothes On. And something from France, a band called The Cosmic Plot with Flanger in the Night. And then some more stuff from England I like a lot. Black Mamba Beat. And with Beat Over Brains. Great tune. Great recording technique, too. David Bowie, Raw Power Consultant. Raw Power Knowledge. Mr. David Bowie. I don't know, just a guess at that. And then we ended up with a band from Orange County, DMF. Got to play with them on Halloween in their neck of the woods. The Doll Hut and something called Truck. And here's something from Canada. Watt from Peter's Show.
When you're Soviet Union maintaining an impressive lead over the United States in manned orbital flights. During a 24-hour period in mid-August, the Soviets placed two men into similar orbits, so similar, in fact, that they were able to see each other. The first of the space twins to go into orbit was Andrian Nikolaev in Vostok 3. This is what he sounded like as he reported back to Earth. Just over 23 hours later, Pavel Popovich in Vostok 4 was placed in an orbit that brought him within sight of Nikolaev. These two men traveled millions of miles in space concurrently and spent a total of more than 160 hours in space. Despite the Soviet achievement, President Kennedy, in an address delivered at Houston's Rice Stadium, said,
"No nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. And this generation does not intend the founder and the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it."
Then the president charted the free world's first goal in space.
"We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon. To go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that challenge is one that we're willing to accept and one we intend to win on the other side."
Earlier in the year, after repeated delays, the United States launched its first astronaut into orbit.
5, 4, 3, ignition. 2, 1, 0, ignition. Liftoff.
MA-6, launch vehicle stream high into the sky with all 5 inches.
Colonel John Glenn, a 40-year-old Marine pilot, rode his Mercury capsule 3 times around the Earth. As soon as he entered orbit, Glenn commented on weightlessness and the view. By his overshooting the landing spot by some 250 miles. Then in October, Commander Walter Chiron took his Mercury capsule on a 6-orbit flight around the world. On his return, he summed up his flight this way.
"Go for a flight. I thought, excellent flight. We had some
snap and saw." Next spring, Gordon Cooper will take a 24-hour journey through space. Despite the Soviet lead, National Aeronautics and Space Administration Chief James Webb maintained,
"My own belief is that the bringing to bear through the resources that the government is applying the utilization of those resources to mobilize industry will give us a position satisfactory to the United States.
I was talking to you just the other day about how things go and the way things went. 5 o'clock in the evening there, dinner is on the table again. What was I about to say? Things didn't turn out the right way. I held too close, I pulled too near. You were walking, getting out of here. Then I thought I heard you turn around. Love can make such a beautiful and quiet sound.
Pedro Show. Yeah, start off with something from Canada, from the Kings of Lower Town, Step Inside Our Lives. And then something from Joshua Tree here in Cali, out in the desert. From Paul Anker, we got Tank, and that's for, it's a father and son team. And that's for the dads there, Dad, who, well, it's Veterans Day today, so that's for him. And then we ended up with Jimmy Ohio doing Quiet Sound. Yeah. Father and son team, Paul Anker, Larry and Leo. Good cats. And we're coming on the end of the November 11, 2009 edition of the Watt from Pedro Show. Again, big thanks to James Williamson for doing that spiel with me while we were down in Brazil. In 10 days, I leave for 2 weeks in Italy to do 6 gigs and make an album. And then New Year's gig in Tokyo, make an album, Brothers, Sisters, Daughters, second one. Thanks for having me aboard. And remember, keep your powder dry.